Artis Analytica is a geospatial infrastructure company. It means we are building solutions around the kinds of data that you can get from satellites and geospatial assets. We often assume that most countries have this kind of technology, maybe it's classified or whatever, but it turns out it's actually not as common as you think. And especially the software around the downstream applications for analysis is not as readily available.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the EVN Disrupt podcast. My name is Nejdet Zatouryan. I'm the editor of the tech section here at EVN Report. Our guest this week was Babken Degrikoyan, the co-founder and CEO of Kartes, a geospatial analytics company. We spoke about the importance of geospatial analytics in national defense applications, why space tech is an important sector for Armenia, and what regulatory environment is necessary for encouraging greater activity in the space. Thank you for listening. Babken, welcome to the podcast.
Nejdet, thanks for having me.
We've been talking about this for a long time. We're finally doing it.
Yeah.
Let's just start with Kartes. What is Kartes?
Kartes Analytica is a geospatial infrastructure company. What does that mean? It means we are building solutions around the kinds of data that you can get from satellites and geospatial assets. And that's not just about sort of optical images. That's actually quite a wider range than that. So there's radar-based data, there's thermal data. So what we've noticed is that there's actually been a very big paradigm shift in the space over the last few years. The things that are possible today weren't possible even a few years ago. If you look at the number of satellites in space in orbit today, it's more than doubled since 2020. It's more than quadrupled in the last 4 years. So
The number of satellites in space has quadrupled over the last 4 years.
Yeah, and it's only exponentially growing.
And that's a result of the price of sending something to space becoming drastically lower?
It's a price of a couple of things. Yeah, essentially it's the price of the launch price going down, but it's also the result of the, I guess, the privatization and the liberalization of the space sector in general globally. What that means is that the problem that used to be around data access is essentially a solved problem. But that presents a completely different new problem, which is now there's too much data. And if you want to pull out intelligence and analytics from satellite-based data, it's no longer something that can be really done effectively, manually, or individually. It's something that requires enterprise-level workflows. It requires AI-based tools because there really is a very rich data set that you can get. And it's not just about the amount of data that's available. It's also about the diversity of data that's now available. So if a few years ago, really, we were talking about, again, optical, like just images, essentially like Google Maps style, today we're you can get all sorts of information, everything from radar-based, radio frequencies, weather, thermal, you name it. And each one gives you something that the other one doesn't.
Right.
So it's about understanding what all of them collectively can give you.
So each of those modalities, there's intersections between those modalities that gives you some piece of information that looking at just images from satellites wouldn't.
Correct. So that's what's called the spectral resolution. But there's also the temporal and the spatial. So the temporal is really about how often you can get this data. Planet Labs did something very, I think, revolutionary. They were one of the first ones. Instead of innovating on the tech on the satellite, they actually went with quite low tech or off-the-shelf tech, built these little shoebox-sized satellites and launched about 150, 200 of them all at once. And they're able to give you very high temporal resolution, which means essentially we can get data from them on a daily or even sub-daily basis. So that also changes the game.
It changes the game based on the quantity of it, though, essentially?
Changes the game in terms of, yeah, how often you're getting
updated
information.
Okay. Can you give us an idea of when you talk about these different modalities that are being collected now, these different types of data that's being collected now, in addition to imagery, you mentioned, I forgot it already, but...
Radar-based, it's called synthetic aperture radar.
Can you just give us an idea of what those modalities are?
Sure.
And where you get more valuable information at those intersections?
Sure. And I'll try not to get too pedantic about it.
Get as pedantic as you want.
Okay. The one we're really focusing on is called synthetic aperture radar.
Okay, what is that?
It is the only one that's it's called active remote sensing. So instead, if most other remote sensors or remote sensing data, it's passive, which is it just receives, you know, essentially from either from sunlight or anything else. Synthetic actuator actually sends out a radio frequency signal, a radar mm-hmm. signal, and receives back the bounce back mm-hmm. and creates a radar-based image. And it's synthetic aperture because it actually, as the satellite moves in its orbit, you can turn that distance into a synthetic aperture. So you can capture a lot more high resolution with it. Now, why does that matter? What is the advantage of synthetic aperture radar? It captures in the day and in the night. So it doesn't matter what time the satellite's flying over. It can capture through clouds, really essential. So that's been one of the biggest downsides to optical-based satellite. Mm. And it's really good at identifying man-made objects in nature and really good at identifying, doing very accurate change detection across time.
So change detection meaning like you're observing one spot on Earth and you're noticing changes, like for instance, digging taking place in that space or new structures being built in that space, things like that?
Yeah, essentially with SAR, because it's radar-based, you can actually, it depends on the provider, of course, but you can get up to millimeter changes if you do the right kind of analysis. Now, the downside to SAR is that it's very difficult to work with. As a data type. Actually, there's open source SAR. The Sentinel-1 satellite from the ESA is open source. But unless you know what you're doing with it, it doesn't really matter that it's open source. You can't really do much with it.
So there are people like specialized to look at that type of data?
Yeah. And so, you know, with CARTAS, it essentially started as a assignment in my old job. When I was at the UN. I was asked to find out where they could do field visits right after the September attacks. Mm-hmm. And I went down a rabbit hole that I basically never got out of. Came across Sentinel-1, Sentinel-2, which is the optical ESA satellite, some NASA open source satellites. And the stuff that I found really shocked me. I was even a little scared for about 2 days. I didn't know what to do with that kind of information. You know, I took care of the assignment in the most minimal way needed, but the really important stuff, I got it to the hands of the people that needed to see that. And that's sort of how CARTAS was born.
What was it you saw that scared you?
I mean, I could tell you exactly where the invasions were.
Right.
Where they had crossed the borders. There was evidence of attacks on civilian infrastructure.
And this is all through publicly available tools. At the time, you weren't specialized in this very specific thing.
Well, with the exception of SAR. So then I reached out to a friend of mine from UCLA who had a PhD in geography, who specialized in SAR, and he also helped me process some more stuff. And that's when things got really interesting, especially when we started fusing the data between the optical and the SAR and the thermal and all of that. That's where you really got to see a full picture of what had taken place over those 3 days.
So at the time you were doing this not for the Armenian government, you were doing it for the UN, but recognizing the importance of what you had dug up, you took it to right people within the Armenian state apparatus, and you realized that there's you must have realized that they weren't already working with this data. So the Armenia did not have the infrastructure, I guess, to be working with this kind of data and actively utilizing it. Is that fair to say? And that's the opportunity you saw to fill that gap?
I think we often assume that most countries have this kind of technology. Maybe it's classified or whatever. Yeah. But it turns out it's actually not as common as
you think.
And especially the software around the downstream applications for analysis is not as readily available. So
it's usually just the raw data that you can get. Yeah.
Because up until very recently, that was the main problem, was actually just accessing this kind of data. So that's why the software around it is either very cumbersome, not very vertically focused, or is not available to most countries outside of, you know,
the United States and large players like that.
Exactly. So, you know, part of the market research that we did was to really try to understand, you know, why this was the way it was, why there hasn't been this kind of development. And that's when we found this opportunity. But the current solutions that exist are either very general, they're different tools that don't really link up to each other. Mm-hmm. They often require domain level expertise and geospatial or geography level expertise, remote sensing expertise, which is a very small niche, and they're not available more widely.
Right.
So we decided to focus on a specific vertical, and our vertical is national security and defense. Mm-hmm. The reason we're doing this is because we think by building a solution and a system that has a specific vertical in mind, we can optimize for that. And so we no longer need to be building for users that have remote sensing expertise. We can focus on users that have that only that domain
right.
expertise
right.
and let the software do the rest.
Right. So you said something interesting that up until, I guess, the last 4 or 5 years, simply accessing the data was the bottleneck here. And I guess accessing that data was so difficult or cumbersome that the players who could access the data already had the infrastructure to work with it. So for countries like Armenia, I guess it wasn't even in the, it wasn't even a thought, I guess.
Well, I wouldn't say it wasn't a thought. Armenia has launched a satellite in the last couple of years.
I mean, before the past 4 or 5 years, yeah. Up until a few years ago, it was only accessible to far more developed countries that had access to both the data and the infrastructure at hand. Today, if you look at the landscape, is this something that almost all countries or most countries or more countries are looking at as an integral part of their overall national security and defense infrastructures?
I would say so. And it's something that's rapidly growing. And what's really interesting about this field is we're still discovering the things that you can do with this kind of data. Obviously, national security defense is, it's our focus and it's sort of the first obvious focus, but everything from emergency situations to
agriculture,
disaster reduction, mining, insurance policy. The applications of this are really, we're just at the very beginning. Some of the predictions about just the geospatial analytics market are about a 61% annual growth rate over the next 10 years.
Right. It's going to be increasingly relevant to a whole lot of sectors in the near future. Yeah.
Yeah.
But focusing on the vertical that you guys have picked, which is national defense, what's something that having the capability to process this kind of data would have given us in 2020 and 2022 and 2023? Or in general, can you just paint us a picture of how this helps improve Armenian national defense?
Sure. So there's a couple of ways in which this can be used. And I would divide them between sort of tactical, operational, and strategic. Tactical being information that would help troops on the ground. Operational being information that would help organize certain operations. And strategic being more long-term, not necessarily troop-related, but more broadly national security, looking at, you know, trends over the course of a few months, a few years.
So even something as simple as that, like just understanding, I don't know, troop buildup or new trenches along the border, things of that nature, is something we didn't have good visibility into without.
I don't want to speak to what we had or didn't have, because I don't think I'm best placed to speak about that. And also keep in mind, satellites aren't the only ways you can get that sort of data anyway.
You have people on the ground.
So. Yeah. Essentially, we want our national security decision makers to have the most accurate and well-synthesized information possible to make the best decisions possible. This is the assumption that with more information, you can make better decisions.
How does CARTAS fit into this? What exactly is it that you guys are building that will help make this more operational for Armenia?
So obviously we're focusing on our analytics platform, but like I said, we're working on a solution because we do think that when you focus on a specific vertical, you want to be optimized for that vertical. And that includes space assets, ground stations, et cetera. And this is why, you know, CARTAS is essentially, at its essence, a space tech company. Mm-hmm. We recently received our space activities license. We're the first private enterprise in Armenia to receive one. Of course, Bazumk and CSIE and the pioneering work that they've done with Hayasat-1 was an inspiration, and we're working with them. And we're going to continue working with them on anything in this space in the future. But really, we see ourselves as one of the vanguards of the Armenian space sector.
Mm-hmm. You said you guys are also working on building hardware. What does that mean exactly? Like, is it building a satellite that is, for instance, like a satellite that would be optimized to collect this kind of data that you guys are working with? Or?
So I think, yes, we do need to get to a place where, and I think we can get to a place where we can be building our own commercial satellites in Armenia.
Is that something you foresee like Karta's doing? Or,
you know, or is it... the space sector is very unique in that it requires collaboration.
Right.
And I do see Karta's, and we are participating in, for example, the next generation of Hayasat.
Right.
We're working on roadmaps for the next both public and commercial satellites. So, but you know, this is going to take time. We need to have the proper infrastructure in place to be able to do some of the manufacturing right. in Armenia, to have the proper tech transfers, to have it's the proper expertise, knowledge transfers, all of that. So, you know, we're involved in all yeah. sorts of that.
You said you guys are involved in the next iteration of Hayasat 2. Can you speak a little bit about
it's still in its very early stages. But, you know, Hayasat 1 was the first domestically built satellites. It was the second satellite that's been launched from by Armenia, but the first domestically built, and also the first non-state satellite. Let's not forget right. that as well.
Bazumka is a private entity.
Correct. Bazumka is a non-state, non-profit research lab. And, you know, that project is going to continue. And we see this as a place where, together with Bazumka and others in the sector, I don't want to you know, be leaving anyone out. I think this is going to be, this is going to grow to be a very diverse coalition and consortium almost of everyone who is involved in the space sector in Armenia. We want to steadily, but very intentionally grow our capacities to do this stuff in Armenia.
Mm-hmm. End to end.
Exactly.
The whole life yeah. cycle. Yeah.
So, you know, what we're focusing on is more on the payload side, more on the sensor side, more on the integration with analytics mm-hmm. and... that's, I think, where our strength can be.
Speaking more broadly about the space sector in Armenia, there's a few players now. You guys are in the space. Bazumka is obviously one of the leaders, as you mentioned. What is there to do in Armenia in the space? And by in the space, I mean like literally in the space, not in space. But like, because when you look at larger ecosystems like the US, China, Russia, the first thing that comes to mind is like launch systems, manufacturing very large satellites, space systems, things of that nature. For a small country like Armenia, what is the opportunity? What is it that's actually possible to be done from here? And what is it that's important?
That's a great question. First of all, I think the space sector in Armenia is a, it's an imperative. It's, you know, we're a landlocked country. We have the sky and the space, and we need to maximize our capacities in these areas. Yeah, we're not going to be, I think, launching things out of Armenia anytime soon, but that's okay because I feel like that has essentially been commoditized. There's partners in the US, partners in India, partners in France, all over that can provide that you know, taxi service to space. Mm-hmm. What Armenia's potential strength is in this area is, I think, in what we bring with our IT sector. You know, my sort of critique of Armenia's IT sector has always been that we have some really bright minds, incredibly bright minds here, but, you know, they spend their days focusing on building gambling software.
There's this great line from, I can't, maybe Elon, or maybe it was a VC, but in the like heyday of the Web 2.0 era, there was this talk of like how Silicon Valley has turned away from science. And the line was something like, there's a lot of big minds working to sell you ads
or
build a photo sharing app.
Right.
And then post like 2015, 16, that might just be when I've observed it, but post around like over the last 8-9 years, the Valley has really taken a shift back to science, I would say. Like you have these really serious deep tech companies like the OpenAIs of the world, the Anthropics. SpaceX has been around for like 20 years now. There's much more happening in space and in the like in the space sector, I mean, within the Valley than compared to 30 years ago. So I think that's a really like important and accurate observation.
And nothing to, you know, I don't want to knock any particular company.
For sure.
Vertical SaaSs are important and all of that. But we're
and
now
economics
at a critical,
drives a lot of things, yeah, but there's a lot of like strategic things that sometimes
exactly,
are left out. Yeah.
Exactly. And now I think we're at a place, we have that critical mass in Armenia. We have that, those bright minds in Armenia focusing on AI, focusing on really the latest tech that can be used more strategically.
Yeah.
And the space sector is a really great way to do that.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's more of a collaborative space, and you're always going to have the involvement of the state in that sector, for better or worse. But there's an increasingly bigger opportunity for the private sector to get involved and to do so in a more collaborative way, as opposed to sort of a Wild West kind of IT kind of way. Yeah. And so what Armenia can bring to this is some of that expertise. A lot of what happens in space and a lot of what is driving the growth in the private space sector is not the launch pads. It's the CubeSats that are doing really innovative things. It's the software in CubeSats. It's the software for downstream applications. Yeah. It's using that data in sectors that aren't directly space space sectors, but are benefiting from space-related tech. Yeah. These are, I think, where Armenia has a big potential to grow.
Launch vehicles, like rockets, are almost like, if you take the analogy to IT more broadly, are kind of like building the internet and building like server systems. And
cloud systems.
Yeah, it's like the oracles of the world. And that's the underlying infrastructure that actually powered everything we use today, from my computer that's in front of me to all the web apps that I use to what's on my phone to OpenAI, et cetera.
Right.
Like, so I think it's a really good point. And it's also, that's usually where the rest of the world also sort of comes in. Because again, it's typically the United States of the world and countries of that nature that initially have the capital to build that underlying infrastructure that makes it possible for private companies and the rest of the world to start participating in it. So if that's sort of the moment we're at in space, you would say, like, there's now there exists an opportunity for a small private company in a small country to have a say in it.
I would agree with that statement. I would caveat that. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done to create an enabling environment for private space in Armenia. The space license, for example. So we do have a law on space activities. It's a pretty decent law. It was passed in 2020, I think just before the pandemic started, actually. But, you know, that was supposed to be the beginning of the story, and it seems to be where things kind of got stuck.
What's the bottleneck?
You know, the law defines the role of an authorized body on space activities, essentially an Armenian space agency. We haven't really had one yet. There's the licensing and the oversight and the regulatory part of it that hasn't really been fully developed. The fact that we're the first private enterprise to get a space license is not a positive thing, I think. I mean, for the company it is, but for Armenia, there should be hundreds of companies that have space activities license. There should not be such a high barrier to entry.
When did you say the law came into effect?
2020.
So it took 4 years for the first private company to become licensed.
Right.
And I'm guessing nonprofits like Bozumk also have.
So Bozumk has space activities license number two. We have number three.
Okay.
So yeah, they are. That's why.
Who's number one?
Number one is a state-owned enterprise called Geocosmos.
Okay. Interesting. What do they do?
They officially operate ArmSat 1.
Okay.
But for the longest time, they were the only...
They're the only licensed company. Yeah. There's also something to be said about, you know, again, like going back to comparing to very large ecosystems and economies like in the U.S., of course, in the U.S. as well, the state plays an important role in setting direction. They incentivize things by aligning grants with what the country needs and things of that nature. But there's so much capital there that smart investors can also set a lot of direction. In a country like Armenia, where you're much more capital limited, the VCs that exist in the country are maybe not writing checks the size that like a space company necessarily needs in the beginning. There's much more of a role for the state to set incentives and decide on a direction that the country needs.
Sure. Right? So let me give you a really good example of where I think state actions would actually help incentivize venture capitals in this sector. You know, one of the things we noticed with Cartes was that right out of the bat, because space is so expensive, we were basically priced out of even the angel investor circuit from the beginning.
Because you needed so much capital.
Exactly. It just wasn't going to, the amount of effort that was going to take was not going to be enough for us to do anything worthwhile. There is a international agreement called the Artemis Accords. It's led by NASA. It's got about, I believe, about 30 countries right now. It's setting a framework for international cooperation to complement the UN Outer Space Treaty and also to incentivize international participation in the Artemis program, which is the next generation NASA program to the moon. Right. You know, Artemis the being system, the sister of Apollo.
Right.
What venture capital firms in the space sector essentially do is look at the Artemis Accords as a sort of litmus test for investing in countries or investing in companies in countries that have signed on to the Artemis Accords. So one thing that the Armenian government can do is something we've been supporting as well with, you know, policy advocacy, is for the Armenian government to sign on to the Artemis Accords. The indications I get is that this is going to happen actually relatively soon, and that these discussions have been under place. But that would actually help a lot in signaling to the global VC world, space tech VC world, that Armenia is a serious player in this sector, and that, you know, the fact that we have a space activities law is already a big deal. Mm-hmm. I think you know, not a lot of countries, or not as many countries as you would think, have initial frameworks for this. So the fact that Armenia already does that is a very good thing, and we need to use that as a stepping stone to the next step. Mm-hmm. So part of that would be building a space agency. Right. Part of that would be joining these sort of international agreements. These would also help facilitate the tech transfers and the knowledge mm-hmm. transfers. If there's a coherent vision for this, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that we can get very quickly in a short mm-hmm. amount of time. But that's what's needed.
When you normally think of a space agency, you think of it in the context of countries that actually go to space. But I guess now that, as you put it, getting to space has become commoditized, is it something you see that basically all countries will have a space agency for just their general activities in space? Because a space agency is something like, it's not a handful of countries, but it's not like all UN members.
You would be surprised how many countries have space agencies.
Really? Yeah. I thought it was more like just the NASA's of the world.
No. In fact, just in the last 5 years, the number of space agencies itself has...
So again, it's recent.
It's recent. And part of it is because you need a space agency in order to help facilitate the private sector of space as well.
Right.
To leverage the private sector of the space for your national space ambitions, national space programs. And I would disagree that you need that only countries with launch capabilities are the ones that, you know, require space agencies.
Right. Because now it's opening up.
Correct. And also launches are no longer done by space agencies.
That's true. SpaceX does, like, I forget the number, but it's some overwhelming majority of
both of Armenia's satellites. So Armenia is in space already. Right. Let's not forget that. And both of them were launched by a private space company.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, you don't need your own NASA anymore, I guess. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, no, you do need your own NASA. NASA is not going to be the one launching it into space, and that's okay. You don't need your own Apollo program.
Yeah.
It's like a Yandex.
Yeah, a very expensive
Yandex.
But still cheap enough to get there. Yeah. What's your, this will be a good gateway transition to speaking a little bit about how you got into space, but starting a startup is one thing. There's a million places you can go and hear about how other people have done it and learn stuff. How do you get started in the space business? Like, how do you start a space tech startup? Where do you look for opportunities?
You start by dreaming.
Okay.
Space is a sector with so much untapped potential that, you know, you can start down one rabbit hole and never get out, and just find creative solutions to problems on Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, space is not just about, in fact, it's predominantly not about, at least when it comes to countries like Armenia, about exploring the cosmos and finding, you know, distant nebulas. Although that's cool too.
But there's lower hanging fruit.
there's things that space is the sector that can help you solve problems here on the ground in a very tangible way. So how do you start? You start by seeing what problems you want to spend your life addressing.
So you, in that sense, it's largely like starting any other company. You shouldn't be scared of the idea that, oh my God, it's in space.
Yeah. I would say so. I mean, it's like starting any, it's like committing to anything. Yeah.
So you've had a long career in, how would you, in the public sector.
Had a very short career in the public sector, well, but sure.
But in the government, you maybe had a short stint as a former minister, acting minister. But you were at the UN, and you've been at other NGOs. Why make the transition to space entrepreneurship?
Space is, in many ways, my first love. It was something, you know, I grew up in the backyard of JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, one of the NASA research centers. And our high school was, you know, had a partnership with them. And it was something that, you know, as a child, I remember when the Space Shuttle Endeavour landed at Edwards Air Force Base in 92. I remember when watching the Pathfinder land on Mars on July 4th, 1997. So, you know, it's not, and to me, it's not something new. What is new is realizing that there is a mission here to be done. And really what CARTES is a mission. It's something both myself and the whole team really feels passionately about. Yes, it's a business. Yes, it's financially viable and it will grow and become successful financially as well. But it's not just about the business. We are a value-driven mission at CARTES.
Yeah.
So that's what drove my shift to what you called space entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
You know, I think the one really important thing about space entrepreneurship, as you said, and this is very different from, you know, my time in government or any other roles, is you're nothing without a team, without your team. And I've been extremely, extremely privileged and lucky to have a superstar team. With our co-founding team and with our development team. You know, we don't always agree, and that's, I think, the healthy part of it. We have a very healthy way of engaging in the problems until we come to an optimal solution. That's something that we none of us could have figured out on our own. And I'm really grateful for the team that we've been able to build at CARTES. And that's why I feel good about where we're going to be.
It's so interesting though, like even listening to that, you couldn't have done this in like when you were graduating college.
No.
You're not because of anything other than the fact that it wasn't possible. Right?
Correct. If you wanted to do this when I was graduating college, NASA, you'd go work at JPL.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you would need to have an electrical engineering degree.
Yeah, exactly. Or a PhD probably.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that yet. And I think like, you know, guys like you and you're probably the fourth or fifth person we've had on. We've had on Nersis and David, who are both involved in Bosum, I believe. We've had on Masis, who was involved in the Hayasat 1 project. And I don't think people yet realize that this is now something that's an actual opportunity. Maybe it's not as easy as launching like an app or something, but it's no longer in the gates of JPL, as you put it. And I think you guys need to sort of popularize this idea more, especially because as we're moving forward, a lot of tech is becoming very quickly commoditized, and the competitiveness of something that was maybe more competitive 24 to 36 months ago today is becoming accessible to many. And I'm talking mostly in like the software space now, but whereas places like space are still important niches, if you can call it that, where if you become competitive, then globally you're more important and more competitive. I think there's some work to do in Armenia to spread that idea more.
Yeah. And it's a space, pun not intended, where there's a lot of room for innovation.
Yes.
I think more so than what's been driving the IT sector for the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Babken, before we move on to the traditional final question, you moved to Armenia, what, more than 10 years ago now?
12 years ago.
12 years ago. Yeah. You've done a lot throughout your 12 years here. This is just the most recent chapter. What's your message to diasporans who are thinking about becoming repats, moving to Armenia, people who want to be more engaged with Armenia? What have you learned over the last 12 years that I wish I would have listened to, I would have heard 5 years ago when I moved here?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, my thinking on this has changed a lot over the last 12 years. Really, the only message I can have for the diaspora is that you shouldn't experience Armenia through the mediation of the internet. Mm. Armenia is a real place. And if there's only one advice I could give is, you know, build your own personal relationship to Armenia, not one mediated by other organizations or the internet or media or your family even. You know, come spend time, enough time here so that you have a personal relationship on your terms to Armenia. And then after that, make whatever decision feels right, whether that means to move here, whether it means to never come back here, although I would hope that's not the case. And, you know, for example, applying for citizenship, I think is for me was one of the ways to do that, because you create that direct link to the state. Mm-hmm. And if there's, you know, the biggest lesson I've learned here is the state is what exists and what matters.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And if I could add something as someone who's been here for like a third of the time, yeah, but come and integrate. Like, I think one thing that a lot of diasporans do, which I think is like the biggest mistake you can do when trying to understand more about Armenia or deciding to live in Armenia, is they come and they exist in a bubble.
Yeah, if I was going to hang out with a bunch of diasporans, I'd stay in the diaspora. Yeah. You know?
No, but more importantly, like, speak with people like in your field here. And they're the ones who have the understanding of, like, if you were to come and spend your life here, what it is you'd be working on, like, on a daily basis. And people in Armenia are extremely open to, like, a cold email, a cold Facebook message, and engaging with people like that. That's how I first met people in the tech sector in Armenia,
sure,
long before I moved here. I think that's like step one. So I really like what you said about build your relationship with Armenia, not based on other people's opinions. Because one flaw Armenians have is that we love Armenia so much that we have such strong opinions about it that we try to impose it on other people.
Yeah,
but it's a flaw.
And you know, if it comes from a good place. Everyone's entitled to their opinions.
For sure,
I would only urge that those opinions be
your own. Yeah,
and for sure. And be built on your own personal relationship to Armenia.
For sure.
Not mediated by someone else or something else.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when they don't need to be.
Yeah.
There's a plan. Like,
exactly.
Last question, Babken. Where do you hope to see Kartas in 5 years?
In 5 years? I see Kartas as a global player in the space sector with a competitive solution for geospatial analytics, with possibly a couple of space assets and maybe couple of ground assets. I see us going places.
You'll come back on in 2029 to talk about it. Thank you so much, Babken.
Thank you.